What's up, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mr. Movie. I'm your host, as always, Josh Bergman, and today I have my co-host, Jeff Bergman. Jeff, how you doing?
Heidi, heidi, ho.
Jeff, this is a very important time in the episode, in the show, because as we've been talking about for months, the Oscars were happening. We were talking about them with the predictions. We were then in the limbo period, and now we're in the post-Oscars world. I don't even know what world this is right now. I don't know what to look forward to, but the big thing today is that Oscars 2020 or Oscars 2021 just happened. A lot happened. And also, in addition to that, we're going to be talking about the new upcoming film, In the Heights. We are very lucky and grateful enough to get a screener of it. And in addition to that, we're going to be making our list of the top 10 New York City movies. How you feeling?
I'm feeling great. You know, Lin-Manuel Miranda gave us a call, invited us over to his house so he can screen the movie for us. So
it was very generous.
Very cool.
Yeah, and then he tried to perform Hamilton. We're like, no, Lin, just let us watch In the Heights. But Oscars, let's just get right into it. Oscars 2021 happened. Sadly, this was the lowest viewed Oscars of all time. It just earned over 10 million viewers compared to last year's, in which there was 26 million viewers. The year before that, 2019, there was 28 million viewers. Of course, this was to be expected as a combination of decline in cable people, people having TVs and watching it live. All live award shows this year have had major decrease and also lack of interest in movies. And, you know, there were some surprises, there were some great things, there were some bad things that happened, but overall, what'd you think of the 2021 Oscars?
Well, I think they really missed the boat on entertaining the audience, I felt. There were less clips from the movies than were ever before. You know, the tributes that they have, there weren't like some great, like, you know, they could have done a Sean Connery clip, they could have done a Chadwick Boseman, like a serious, you know, musical tribute or something, you know, because they didn't use any entertainment at all. They didn't use the Kodak Theater. They didn't have like a, you know, they could have had dance people in the theater, you know, or a routine, or, you know, they performed the songs in the pre-show instead of during the show.
What'd you think of that? You saw like half of them.
I mean, I didn't mind it because I watched it, but the problem was the show itself was just awards, long speeches. Right? There was no humor. There was no stand-up. Nobody did a routine. I mean, Little Rel did a little thing in the middle of the show, but I felt that it was kind of boring. I mean, they didn't make it, and it's all about entertainment. Or let's say all these great movies are coming out, right? Yeah. Why wouldn't you have Scarlett Johansson? Why wouldn't you have all the stars of all these great movies that are coming out? Or have interesting people give out the awards like together, you know?
I mean, they did have Brad Pitt.
I understand.
Who doesn't love a good Brad Pitt?
You know, but, you know, I know they didn't want to have like two people, but like, you know, you can bring like famous duos up, like, I don't know, Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman from Rain Man, or like Thelma and Louise, or just famous, you know, people. Or they could have also done as like ABC, since they own, they could have had a scene from Black Widow that nobody had ever seen before in the middle of the award show.
Well, they kind of did that with, most importantly, West Side Story, which we got the first trailer ever for the new upcoming musical, West Side Story, directed by Steven Spielberg, coming this Christmas. Just as a side note, I think it looks incredible. Despite some potential people in the film, I just thought, like, visually, it looks great. I only saw a 10-year-old, like, 10-year-old performers, that type of performance of West Side Story. Besides that, I know nothing.
So you never saw the original movie?
There is a dance-off that they throw someone off the stage. I'm pretty sure that means they killed someone. But because this was performed by a bunch of 10-year-olds. But I'm excited for that. And we got a trailer for In the Heights and Questlove's new documentary. Interesting enough, all the trailers they premiered were music-based. I just thought, why don't they have a Black Widow or Jungle Cruise or something for Cruella? It was a bit interesting. But to go into some of your points before, the comedy, very lacked. Lorel's segment in which, at the hour 2 mark, in which he had, let's like guess the song or sing along, and he had Andra Day, who started cursing up a storm, and then Glenn Close doing Da Butt, which in a way is the best and worst of the Oscars, because personally, I enjoy that, because for once I said, oh, like, they're trying to have fun. Because the rest of the show, you're right, it was not that much fun. The show opened with Regina Hall walking through all of Union Station, and Steven Soderbergh produced it, and it looks very cinematic. I don't know if you noticed, but they had black bars up on top and bottom of the screen to make it look like a wide movie presentation. And I thought, oh, that's cool for the opening. And they had it for the entire performance, which I just thought, It was, like, unnecessary. I don't know if you really...
or I didn't even notice it.
I haven't heard anyone talk about it on Twitter, on other podcasts. Like, I'm not crazy. It's presented like that, so I thought that was weird. But then Regina... No, it was Regina King. Regina King walked through Union Station, and then she just starts the show. She has a little monologue, and then quickly just went into screenplays. And not only is she presenting screenplays, but she talks about the writers, and then we don't see anything of the film, of the dialogue, or some of the action. And I think that this show was very unique in which it's very much an inclusive. Like, if you know what's going on, you're fine. We've seen all the movies, so everything they say, like, we know what the father is or who this random supporting actor that's nominated is. But let's say someone who hasn't seen Minari or Judas and the Black Messiah and doesn't have a clip of Daniel Kaluuya yelling some line from the film, they would be like, okay, this guy just won. I have no idea who it is. Like, I like that. Those parts are great. And even with even some of the smaller categories, best sound or best score, We don't get clips of why this movie is nominated for best sound, of like Greyhound with guns and boats happening. So I just thought, like, the clips, I love the clips, bring back the clips, especially when you have Laura Dern talking to these actors in a dress that makes her look like a swan, and it feels very awkward if I'm just yelling at you saying, you are a great actor, and this is why. I didn't like that stuff. But yeah, too much talking is another major point, because as we mentioned, as you were telling us on the night, there were no time limits for any speeches. And sometimes this is good if there's a very random speech out of nowhere that becomes amazing, and like, wow, this guy for documentary short was amazing. But then you have someone for best editing that turns out like it's a dull speech, and then they linger for 6 minutes, which probably sounds like this monologue right now that I'm giving, but I just thought, like, it's, you can have it a great speech or a bad speech, but no matter what, they both go on for 6 minutes, and it was way too long. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, the basic problem with the awards is, you know, unlike the Golden Globes, there's 23 awards at the Oscars, and I would say half of them nobody gives a crap about.
I care about them.
You only care about them, like, if you're doing a pool or something like that, or if you're a movie buff. So what they have to figure out a way is either give out some of these awards at the pre-show, or give them out quickly. And,
well, that's cutting off the speech. Give it quickly then.
Yeah, so you have to give those 12 awards that nobody cares about quickly and cut off their speeches so they're short, and then do some entertainment so that people really enjoy the show. And then for the 12 awards that people care about, they can be, you know, the writers, the directors, the actors, and things like that. And then if you want, like we said last time, add in a couple new awards, like stunts or newcomer or best, you know, first film, that type of thing.
But it was interesting because even with no like random comedy segments or no awkward bantering between the people giving out the awards, the show still was over 20 minutes longer than its normal runtime. It was 3 hours and 20 minutes because, one, the speeches went on for so long, and two, they had two humanitarian awards.
Which they never do.
You don't need to.
They cut out the humanitarian awards, I think, the last couple of, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, I know because after 2020, you want to really give back to the people, but two, I like the Bryan Cranston situation, but I just thought, like, you don't need all of this and then still go too long when you don't have anything entertaining. And then the Lil Rel part was fine, but it felt so random after 2 hours of nothing like this.
Yeah.
But did give us Glenn Close giving a debut, which I'm so happy about. Stupid. And then, which I found out, she was pre-told, like, oh, you should say this. So she knew she was going to say debut.
Yeah.
But she looked up what debut is and on her own decided to dance. The dance was spontaneous.
Oh, I see.
And then let's get to the awards. There were a majority of the awards we kind of guessed in one way or another during our predictions. But some of the major ones, the first thing that really threw me off for the night was that we think Nomadland's going to sweep, including Best Adapted Screenplay. It did not win Best Adapted Screenplay. The Father did, which I thought, okay. And then Best Cinematography. Both of us said Nomadland would win because it's getting so much hype. But Mank won for Best Cinematography, which I'm all down for. And then something happened in which the In Memoriam sped up so quickly, which was random. I don't know why they rushed through a bunch of people's deaths. But then they gave out Best Picture before Best Actor and Best Actress. And we're like, what the hell is going on? And then they gave out the award, and it was Nomadland. I wasn't angry it was Nomadland. I thought, you know what, this could be the year. And end with Frances McDormand howling like a wolf. And I thought, all right, that is weird, but whatever. And I thought, oh, they're having Chadwick Boseman get the award, or his wife, for Best Actor's the last award. They do Best Actress. And then, to a surprise...
Which was a shock. I didn't think Frances McDormand was going to win Best
Actress. I thought it was going to be Carrie, but Frances won. And then she kind of, in a way, blew her load on the... on Best Picture, that she had a dud of a speech. And then for the final award of the night, Best Actor, everyone thought it was Chadwick Boseman, and they announced Anthony Hopkins wins for The Father. He's not there. They show up a picture of Anthony Hopkins, and since there's no host, which I'll get into a second, Joaquin Phoenix, I think, just says, all right, that's the show, good night. And then that's the end! Because he was in London. He was sleeping in Wales because he's 83 years old. He didn't want to be there. And the Oscars wouldn't let him pre-record something. So it ended like a fart. Like, it was the one of the worst endings. And it wouldn't have been as bad if they didn't switch around the if the awards. If Best Picture was last, it would be fine. Frances McDormand wouldn't waste all her howling. And then the Anthony Hopkins, Chadwick Boseman situation... Like, Chadwick Boseman's family was there. Like, they built it up to this is Chadwick's moment, and then gave it to a picture. What'd you think of that? What was your in-the-moments thoughts?
It was a shock, number one, because he had won every other award from every other show, except for the BAFTAs. And, you know, I guess maybe the accountants should have hinted to the producers that you might not want to do that when they decided to do the awards last. You know, do the Best Actor last. And so it was a big dud.
The producers were betting on it, and also it makes it look like, in a way, Anthony Hopkins could be viewed as the villain of, he got instead of Chadwick Boseman, who will never get it again. When in reality, we saw both of them, and we've been saying it, Anthony Hopkins had the better performance.
Yeah.
If it wasn't positioned as the last, then I think that it wouldn't have had that much of backlash.
Yeah, that was a bad idea. You always end with Best Picture because it's the culmination of the night and it's the biggest award of the night. So it was just a silly mistake by the producers.
And a decision that was made for the last 3 years that I think we should really retroact. There was no host. I think they need a host. They need someone.
Or two.
They need someone to bring it all together in the beginning, introduce everyone to a more casual, fun zone, because I know we're still in a pandemic, but... as we said, it wasn't that fun. And then close it out properly.
It was like the Tony Awards without the musical performances.
And I have an idea. We had a little hint of Lorel doing his thing around the room, which I thought was enjoyable, even though it is, in its own way, the worst of the Oscars. But I said in the last episode, Tiffany Haddish should be an Oscar host. Now my new idea is both Lorel and Tiffany Haddish. Not only are they pretty hot right now, they are both charismatic and comedic in their own way, and also they have had previous, like, several different projects together. They have experience with each other. They have chemistry. I think they would do great. I know you're not big on Tiffany.
No, I mean, yeah, no, I don't know.
We just watched her on Price is Right. You didn't think she was good.
No, she was not.
But do you think there should be a host next year?
Yes. I definitely think there, you know, especially, you know, I was listening to Billy Crystal today doing a podcast, and he was saying that a lot of his jokes were spontaneous. You need a comedian who can come up with spontaneous jokes during the broadcast because things happen and it makes it all funnier.
I think I do like it. I like John Mulaney. I'm just saying he's not everyone's cup of tea. A bunch of more bigger, like, general audiences may not be that knowing of him, but I think he's great. I think he can do great. He did the Independent Spirit Awards a couple years ago with Nick Kroll, but I think John on himself would do amazing. I'm all for it. But going into that, we are now at the end of the 2020 Oscars run, and I think it's time to already start talking about the 2021 or whatever, next year's Oscars, because today we're going to be talking about In the Heights. This is the long-awaited and long-delayed musical adaptation of the 2008 Tony Award-winning Broadway musical originally made by Lin-Manuel Miranda. This one is directed by John M. Chu, who recently directed Crazy Rich Asians and Step Up 2 in the Streets and Step Up 3D. As I said, this is based on the musical, and pretty much In the Heights follows this area in Washington Heights in which we follow mostly these four people just trying to live their lives, achieve these goals, whether it's in relationships, love relationships, financial reasons, or traveling somewhere. And for 2 hours and 20 minutes, we follow these characters and their families and listen to a bunch of songs along the way. As I said, we did get a screener of this film. It was an online screener in which we hooked it up to our TV, We did not see this in theaters. What's your experience with Lin-Manuel or In the Heights itself, or your hype towards this movie? What were you feeling going in and coming out?
Well, I was very primed for this movie because I thought it had a Best Picture potential going in. So I was expecting, like, I had high expectations for the movie. I never saw the original Broadway musical, so it was good. That didn't spoil it for me or anything like that. So I just went in fresh-faced and eyes wide open. I knew it wasn't, like, at the level of Hamilton, you know, from a song standpoint. So I wasn't comparing it to Hamilton, really. I was ready to evaluate it on its own terms.
And now that you have seen the movie and not the show, what'd you think of In the Heights?
Well, you know, it was good. Listen, in the last 10 years, we've seen musicals in, you know, Chicago, Dreamgirls. I mean, I know you and Rebecca talked about it in your podcast. So there were a couple of songs that, you know, that we felt like if we were in the audience, we would have stood up and clapped for, because they were big numbers. The opening number, probably the pool number.
96,000.
Right. And the big party number in the second act, or the second part of the movie, I guess you can call it, not the second act. So the numbers were great. I mean, I think Mr. Chu's direction on these big numbers were really good. I mean, it just, you know, the overall story of the movie, it kind of like, you know, I didn't feel like it was so linear. Not that it has to be linear, but I just felt like it lost its way along the way. You know what I mean?
I 100% agree. In which, as I said, we follow four characters. Anthony Ramos, who is in Hamilton, who plays Usnavi, a name that I love. You also got his friend, Corey Hawkins. His name is Benny. You also have Usnavi's love interest, Nina, played by Leslie Grace, as well as Benny's love interest, Vanessa, played by Melissa Barrera. And as I said, Anthony Ramos, he wants to go somewhere when Benny wants to fall in love with this girl. And Vanessa wants her own decision on how she goes to school. When Nina, I think, wants to either do something in fashion or have her own apartment or something like that. Yeah. And these are fine storylines, but the movie's 2 hours and 20 minutes. And for the first 40 minutes, when we got musical number after musical number, especially with the amazing opening, I'm like, let's go. I'm into this. And then eventually I thought, this seems like a lot of musical numbers that don't really amount to that much of a story. And I like more of a story. And then there's one dinner scene that there's no musical numbers for a bit. And like the plot really gets heavy in this dinner scene. And I thought, you know what? I can go for more musical numbers. So in some way throughout the movie, I was on a double-edged sword, because there were moments when there was too much musical numbers. I wanted more of a plot, but then I got bored during the plot moments. I wanted the energy of the musical numbers. But at the same time, it kind of goes into the question of how well can a musical translate to screen? Because sometimes not every performance for a musical number, can translate well to screen. Does it forward the plot that much, or character motivation? Sometimes it doesn't, but that's okay on Broadway. I think it happens in this movie, and I don't think it's for the better of the movie, especially at 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean,
minutes.
There was, you know, the whole scene with the older woman when
Abuela,
that scene, that musical number, like I felt like that was kind of a waste. Like I didn't need it,
but probably in the show it feels more important. But in the movie, it's like, I know what's happening.
Yeah.
It's a nice number. I thought it was a good number. I think it's very much, a lot of these numbers are YouTube clip numbers. Like, I'd watch in the commercial segment.
Mm-hmm.
Or on YouTube, I'd watch 96,000 at the pool.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. There are just certain times where the story didn't mesh together. And another element that kind of also goes into Lin-Manuel's other work is that a lot of this is music based. Like they do a lot of the exposition or motivation or plot progression in the songs. And if you miss out on it in the songs, you can be lost in some storylines. And same with Hamilton. I felt like sometimes I missed some things, which is nice because when I revisit it, I learned something new. Right. But on the first experience, I was a bit lost on a lot of storylines.
And there was a lot of Spanish, and there weren't subtitles, so you missed on all that.
The Spanish was easy stuff. I'm sorry, Dad.
No. Some of it wasn't, you know? But some of the visually, you know, the scenes, like I said, the pool scene, the scene where they sang on the balcony, that was kind of innovative.
That was really cool.
You know, even the opening was great, and that party, the dancing at the end of the, you know, the big dance thing, which...
Yeah.
I kind of really didn't get that whole scene. I don't understand.
They were depressed and they needed something to boost. Like,
no, I mean, there's no, not that scene.
Oh.
The one at the end of the first act where he wouldn't dance with her.
Well, that kind of goes into, there's a big relationship storyline with Usnavi and Nina. Honestly, I didn't buy their relationship. Everyone's like, their chemistry is off the books. And I'm like, I don't get it.
I just didn't understand, like, why he wasn't committing to her right away. Why was he being so aloof? It just didn't make
any
sense.
I don't know. This might be because we didn't see the musical, mm-hmm. and it was in the musical. Or this could just be the movie's fault itself. Like, this is some of the issues in which things just happened for that maybe it's because of the musical, or it was not very well planned out in this.
Right. So, but if you say Chicago is the best movie musical we've seen in the last 10, 15 years, and then you throw, like, Dreamgirls below that, I don't think it was as good as either of those two.
Well, to be fair, I've not seen Dreamgirls. I have seen Chicago. It's more of the translation, I think, in which the musical performances, I think, in this film are great. Individually on their own, all of them, almost all of them are stellar. I think as together with a forward storyline and how it balances all these storylines into a 2-hour and 20-long-minute movie, I don't think it worked as well. Even with something like Les Mis, almost like it's Les Mis is a bit longer, but I think you felt the story. You know what's happening. This mm-hmm. one I felt, it just got a bit lost in what it was trying to achieve. I think as a film, it's going to be humongous. Since we're seeing this a month in advance, it's going to connect with a lot of audiences, the representation. Everyone's going to love that. And everyone's going to fall in love with the musical numbers. But I would wonder if the general audience will pick up on the dullness in some of the plot elements of how the pacing and how sometimes it can be a bit slow. Now that we have one of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway musicals on the screen in a feature-length film, how would you think Hamilton would do? Now that you've seen what this type of musical could be like, do you think it will work well for Hamilton? There's no talks of it yet.
I don't think so.
So you don't think they should do Hamilton as a movie like this?
No.
Well, as I said, we did watch this on our TV in the comfort of our own home. In a month, it will be released in theaters as well as HBO Max. What are you thinking? Would you go back?
You have to see it in the theater. Yeah. With a lot of people. You know, with people. Because it's like seeing a show, and I think together it'll extract more emotions from yourself if you see it with other people in a theater.
I was also wondering if there were certain scenes where I wasn't as emotionally invested. If I was with this big crowd mm-hmm. on like opening weekends, if I would be more invested in it.
Yeah, I don't think there was enough serious drama though that really.
But like the forward progression, the energy of the crowd. Like there's the salon scene early in the film, and I thought that if you're with the right people and people are cheering and clapping to the music, like I think that could just elevate me to be like, I love this a lot more.
I thought the salon scene was kind of a hot mess.
Really?
I did not. It needed.
You didn't like the wig? The wigs on the mannequins
just,
moving.
It just needed to. Well, maybe it was a little long, but I again with the dialogue, I think I missed a lot of part of the plot in that. That whole plot line with the, you know, with all the stores moving out of the neighborhood to another neighborhood because the neighborhood's getting too expensive because it's Manhattan, you know, that whole thing kind of got lost a little bit.
I will also agree because in the end, not saying it didn't get resolved, it had its ending, but it's not like, it didn't feel like it meant anything,
right.
Which kind of was a lot for this film. So who or what now would you say was the star of the film? The one thing you can walk away saying this was great.
The star of the movie, I would say the choreography.
You really, is it the side of the apartment dancing scene?
You know, just the for the musical numbers, whoever did the choreography and the production design and the musical numbers, I think was the winner.
For me, I would just overall say the musical numbers. I like the salon scene, the stuff that when they're dancing at the halfway point in the show at nighttime, I'm not going to say specifically what happens, the opening number, the finale number, the 96,000 in the pool, thought it was all great. I thought like those itself, despite the long runtime, that would get me to go see the movie again in theaters.
Yeah, and I thought also the whole thing where like, I don't know if I should talk about this, but you know, there is something happens in the middle of the movie and they kind of prepare you that it's going to happen. And I didn't think that was necessary. I don't think it's important. I think it should have just happened.
That is true. It's not like a big, whoa, I can't believe this is happening, that we needed a countdown towards it.
Yeah.
But once again, that might be a little, like, in-joke if you've seen the play or the musical, but for someone who's seen the movie, I also agree. I don't think we needed a countdown to this event happening. Yeah. And final question, what would you rank this on the nut scale? Would you give this an almond, a walnut, a cashew, or the almighty peanut?
I would love to give it a peanut, but it falls a little short, so I give it a cashew.
I will also say cashew. I was kind of, I haven't mentioned, but I was kind of in the same position of you, in which I was expecting Best Picture territory, in which I thought the trailer that came out prior to COVID in December 2019, I think is one of the best trailers in recent memory, hypes me up every single time, and that scale, I wouldn't say that the movie sadly lived up to it. The trailer was just like the music, and I thought, this is great, and it was not as high octane as I thought the trailer did lead me onto. I
guess there were some cool cameos if you're a Broadway aficionado.
That is true, especially if you love the work of Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I guess we haven't really talked about it. Awards talk. Oscars. Yes or no?
I think it'll get nominated for Best Picture.
Really?
Because of the scale of it and, you know, the background of most of the people in it, I think it will get a Best Picture nomination.
What about West Side Story? Or will we have two Best Picture nominees? Musical nominees?
What I've said before in this podcast, there are certain movies you don't remake. There's no need for a remake, and West Side Story is one of them. And from what I saw on the coming attraction, it looks just like the original movie, so.
Wow.
Sorry, Steven.
For me, I wouldn't go to say that much of Oscars, but I will say at least a nomination at the Golden Globes for musical or comedy, if you take that as a highlight.
Well, there's going to be a nominee for Best Song, because one of the new songs is at the end of the movie.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, there'll probably be a nominee.
And then there'll be a new song.
Maybe production design, I would think.
Cinematography?
Yeah.
All right, then. As I said, In the Heights, it is in theaters as well as HBO Max starting June 11th. And Dad, since Washington Heights was such a big part of this movie and New York City overall.
And it was filmed on the streets of Washington Heights.
Yeah.
It wasn't filmed on a studio set.
Well, one thing was more concerning is that there were no cars on the streets of Washington Heights, which I think was a bit weird because they were running a lot in the streets. They're lucky there was no traffic. But since we are talking about that, Washington Heights, I thought would be the perfect time to make a ranking of the top 10 New York City movies. These are movies that, as a general whole, take place in New York City. What makes these the top 10 is up to you. It is whether that New York City is pretty much another character in the film, whether the New York City, like this movie cannot take place in any other city, it has to be New York, or whether the area of New York elevates it to something that is incredible. How was it making this list?
It was very hard. I had about 25 movies on this list, and that's not, you know, I left out all Woody Allen movies, so that was my number one rule. And my second rule was at least 95% of the movie had to take place in New York City. Or perhaps even filmed in New York City. Like, if it was like a movie that, let's say, took place in New York City but was filmed somewhere else, that didn't qualify. At least I don't think, I think it's not qualifying. But it might be. I mean, there are a couple movies that I picked that there were some outdoor scenes, definitely in New York City, but there were indoor scenes, could be on sets or whatever. But
I do not have that. I have, you know, it doesn't matter if it's filmed or not, as long as it takes place. Yeah, for me though, this was a bit hard. I was going through a bunch of lists, and I'm like, oh, this movie's good. Oh, this movie's good. And then I'm like, oh, which one really qualifies as New York? Could this be anywhere? I would also say this one was a struggle. But I tried. I'm pretty sure I made sure no other list, no other movie from another list was on my current list for this one, which actually was a bit hard. But I'm still happy with the films I have. What do you have for your number 10 New York City movie?
My number 10 movie is The Warriors from 1979, directed by Walter Hill, who ended up doing 48 Hours. And basically, if anybody who grew up, who was in high school when I was in high school, it was basically the story of this gang of guys who had to make it from the Bronx to Coney Island in one night in New York City without getting killed. And it was basically filmed, you know, on the subways or in the parks, all over New York City. And it was like it has a very, at the end, there's a very famous scene where the guy is holding three bottles and he goes, "Warriors, come out to play." Classic line.
I know that line.
Quoted in a lot of places.
I've not seen Warriors, but as you mentioned, I do know that glass bottle parody scene. Yeah, though, not seen it. Sorry. Hmm. To start off for me at number 10, I'm already going weird, and I got Stuart Little 2. This one, you know, I really enjoyed it as a kid, and I watched it a couple years ago with my friend Zach, previous co-host, and I enjoyed it a lot more. I think it's a really charming film. You got Michael J. Fox as a talking mouse adopted by a human family. You also got Nathan Lane, Hugh Laurie, and a young Jonathan Lipnicki, and you got James Woods as a villain who plays a bird. He's either a hawk or an eagle or something. And this is a nice product of the early 2000s. I love it. They have a cute New York house that's on the side of Central Park. And I love that Stuart Little, he's a small guy and he has a small car that he drives through New York. And I think it makes you feel that you are really a small mouse, per se, in New York City. And I love that his car, it's a toy car, it gets carjacked. Like, all the wheels are taken off and they have cinder blocks holding it up. I think that's a hilarious gag. And I love the use of skyscrapers and the Central Park climax. Charming film. I think it's a bit overlooked in the last 20 years now. 65 million domestically, 166 million worldwide. My number 10, Stuart Little 2.
Yeah, I think both of the Stuart Little movies were really good. I think if you're looking for a great kids movie and, you know, you're looking for something outside of the Disney world, definitely the Stuart Little movies are perfect. All right, so my number 9 movie is My Favorite Year, which is from 1982, directed by Richard Benjamin. And it's basically the story, it sort of takes place in the 50s, and it's the era of, where the Sid Caesar, Your Show of Shows, was a big show back then, and they would bring in random guest hosts, sort of like Saturday Night Live. And the story, the movie takes place where they're bringing in a British actor, sort of like an Errol Flynn type, played by Peter O'Toole, who's sort of a drunk, and Mark Lynn Baker is in charge of, is like his, like, get him to the Greek type character, like Jonah Hill, and get him to the Greek, where he has to make sure he gets to the show on time and all this other stuff. And you know, as the movie goes on, you learn more about Peter O'Toole's character and why he drinks. And Joseph Bologna plays the Sid Caesar character. The mafia has a hit on him and stuff like that. And it's the combination of the two combined at the end. And it was a great, great movie. One of my favorites. My favorite year. Number 9.
I've not even heard
and
of
it. And there's
that.
A great scene in Central Park, too, where Peter O'Toole steals a policeman's horse and rides around Central Park. So
interesting. Again, I've not seen that film. I've not heard of it. Maybe one day.
No, it takes, you know, it's a movie in time. So it definitely translates to, you know, and it's a PG-13. So it's good for the family.
Up for me at number 9, I'm going a bit generic per se, but I'm going The Great Gatsby, the 2013 version directed by Baz Luhrmann, because this is an insane cast in retrospect. You got Leonardo DiCaprio, Carey Mulligan, Tobey Maguire, Joel Edgerton, Isla Fisher, Jason Clarke, and Elizabeth Debicki. Now, 10 years later almost, that's a great cast right there. And this is a visual fever dream thanks to Baz Luhrmann's direction of just some imagery that he has on the screen. I think it's a cool representation of the 1920s, whether it's just people drinking in New York City apartments, or jazz, or Times Square, or all of New York City and Long Island, in which this film mostly takes place in. And it was pretty, I don't know, I'd say important, because it was released right when we were reading it in school. So, like, I was very connected to it at the time. And now, 8 years later, it's, like, stuck with me mentally. 145 million domestically, 353 million worldwide. My number 9, The Great Gatsby.
See, I would have disqualified that movie because half of it takes place on Long Island, which is not New York City.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, but, yeah, I don't know why that book is so popular with high school English teachers. I just don't get it.
Neither, but they made us read it, so.
Yeah, it was a pretty wacky movie, that's for sure.
It's a fever dream that I bet would be great to see under the influence.
You have to say it about Baz Luhrmann, he's a lot of fun. He did Moulin Rouge and, you know, yeah, but I think he has something coming out this year, I think.
Oh, Elvis. Is he doing Elvis?
Well, you'll have to look it up.
What do you have next for number 8?
My number 8 is Black Swan, which is the Mila Kunis, Natalie Portman ballet movie that takes place in New York City because there are two ballet dancers at Lincoln Center. And, you know, New York isn't maybe 100%, you know, the as part of the story, but it's a great movie, you know, because it takes place at the Lincoln Center, which doesn't usually get a lot of play in movies and things like that. I thought it qualified. And, you know, two attractive Jewish women in a movie together, can't beat that.
You were very excited when you realized that there haven't been a lot of movies that feature two Jewish women at the lead.
That is true.
Black Swan, I've really wanted to watch Black Swan. Darren Aronofsky, I just haven't found the time or location. Like, I can't pinpoint this is where I can find the movie. So I've yet to see Black Swan, but I think it's right up my alley.
Well, you know, you really have to concentrate on that movie because it's really messed up.
I am 100% down. I will take a Saturday night, have a cocktail, and watch Black Swan. Up for me at number 8, I'm going a bit smaller here, and I got Little Manhattan. This is a 2005 tween rom-com starring Josh Hutcherson, and it's the perspective.
Oh, yeah, Josh Hutcherson.
This is one of the few films that's a perspective of a 10-year-old living his life in New York City. His parents are divorced, and you know, he lives on the Upper West Side, and at the time when I saw this in 2005, my cousins and an uncle just moved to the Upper West Side, so that was a lot of fun. Him, Josh Hutcherson, as a 10-year-old, he's best friends with the elevator guy in his apartment, and I thought, that's very New York. That's a very New York thing that I've seen. He can scooter around like a 6-block radius around his apartment and Central Park. There's scenes that take place at the AMC Lincoln Square, Central Park. It's a very cute movie. I think this is a nice little independent film gem. Very small. 365,000 domestically, 469,000 worldwide. My number 8, Little Manhattan.
Wow, it didn't do well worldwide. I'm surprised. No, it was a good movie. Very cute. Again, Josh, you're picking like family-friendly movies for your list. That's very mine or not. But, well, actually, my favorite year was pretty. But no, definitely, if you haven't seen Little Manhattan, it's a nice, comfy watch. So my number 7 is The Wiz. Now, The Wiz, which is the musical version of The Wizard of Oz, taken from the 1977 musical, 75. I don't know. I forgot when The Wiz was on Broadway. So what's interesting about The Wiz is they actually filmed it in different parts. I mean, some of it was filmed on a backlot, but they filmed scenes at Yankee Stadium, Shea Stadium. They filmed scenes at the New York Public Library. They filmed scenes like in the 34th Street or the Times Square subway station. They filmed stuff all over New York City. I mean, and think Coney Island too. The Nipsey Russell scene, I think, was at Coney Island. The movie itself, I mean, it's a little long, you know, and some of the numbers they changed from the musical, which I wasn't happy about. You know, Nipsey Russell's song was, I didn't like his, and Michael Jackson's song was changed too, so for the Scarecrow, which I wasn't crazy about. And like I said, the movie was a little long, and Diana Ross is a little old to be playing like Dorothy. You know, she's not a 18-year-old woman, or I don't know.
How old was she in the film?
She had to be in her 30s. At least in her 30s, no question. And she was trying to play younger, and it just didn't come off well. But it was one of the quintessential New York City movies because they filmed in all these weird locations all over New York. So The Wiz, my number 7.
I remember as a kid, it was probably a Saturday or Sunday morning. I said, what should I watch this morning? And you said, here's The Wiz. And I thought, this is a weird movie. I've yet to go back and rewatch it, but I watched the NBC Live version musical. I know of The Wiz. I saw it once as a kid. I've yet to revisit it. I vaguely remember they meet the Cowardly Lion at the library.
Yeah.
I for some reason, I really remember that. Next up for me at number 7, I don't know if you've even seen this one, Premium Rush, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a bike messenger.
I think I saw it on the plane once or something.
Yeah, this was in the weird hype phase of Joseph Gordon-Levitt when he had like 4 big movies in the course of 5 months. As I said, it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a bike messenger. Also in the film, you got Michael Shannon as the villain trying to chase him down. You also have Jamie Chung, just a fan of Jamie Chung. She should be in more stuff. And as I said, it follows bike messengers going around New York, either doing errands for certain people, and the movie travels from uptown down to Chinatown, and you got car chases going through the tough streets in New York, but they're on bikes. And so you can get creative, whether it's going from street to street in heavy traffic or going into a park for some intense chase scenes. I think it's like a fun end of summer thrill ride. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he got really injured during a real accident. Biked himself right into a taxi and cut up his arm. 20.2 million domestically, 31.3 million worldwide. My number 7, Premium Rush.
Yeah, I think I remember. It was a good movie. Very, very enjoyable. And I remember you were really a big fan of that. That's why I saw it.
Aw.
All right, so my number 6, I'm going with American Gangster, which is the movie with Denzel Washington, tells the story of Frank Lucas, and he was a Harlem drug dealer, and it was rise to power in the 70s. So there's a lot of like scenes in Harlem and things like that. Russell Crowe plays the detective who tries to bring him down. But my favorite scene is when they go to Madison Square Garden to watch the famous Ali Frazier fight from March of 1971. So that's why we wanted to throw this in here. The movie was directed by Ridley Scott, who's a great director. And it's just a good, you know, cop, criminal, and he was a great villain, you know, Denzel. So that's what made the movie so good. So that is my number 6, American Gangster.
This one, I did not see American Gangster. It was right before, I was like wrong place, wrong time. It was right before I really got into more adult movies. And I just think given the lower reputation that it has, like, no one's really talking about it that much. I've just had no interest for a Ridley Scott, Russell Crowe, Denzel Washington movie. On paper, that sounds like something I'd watch, but sadly, I've not seen it. We are very bad at watching each other's movies on this list.
Yeah.
Next up for me at number 6, this might be, or this franchise might be, a bit low for your list, if it's even on, Men in Black. Barry Sonnenfeld directed. You got Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. This is the first one. You know, they're traveling through Manhattan. There's a bunch of alien secrets in the streets, whether it's certain aliens in lockers, and there's a bigger or smaller world, or like certain clubs are actually housed by aliens. I love it. It's a very unique story. It's, I guess, one of the biggest fan favorite New York City franchises that take place there. It's fun. It's clever. Very short. It's a brisk watch. And they go to Queens, to the New York State Pavilion, for the climax with the cockroach. I think that's awesome. $250 million domestically, $588 million worldwide. My number 6, Men in Black.
It's the first movie that uses the World's Fair in Queens.
Really?
The second one, I don't know if...
Second one, they go to Statue of Liberty.
No, the second... What was the second movie that used New York City...
Tomorrowland?
No, Iron Man 2.
Oh,
yes. The finale
yes.
is like at the same location.
You're right.
Yeah, I like the first Men in Black. I think the others didn't hold up. But, you know, the first one was pretty clever.
A classic, some may say. Well, Dad, we are now at the halfway point of our list. So I think we're going to be taking a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor, Anchor. And then we'll get right back to the list. Welcome back from the break, everybody. I am joined by Jeff Bergman. We just discussed In the Heights. It will be in theaters as well as HBO Max starting June 11th, and we are in the middle of our top 10 New York City movies. We are at number 5. Jeff, what do you have?
All right. My number 5 is a little under the radar, but it's Nighthawks, the Sylvester Stallone movie from 1981, and he basically plays a cop who's on the hunt trying to stop a terrorist from... doing damage in New York City, the terrorist being played by Rutger Hauer, who's one of the best villains in a movie ever. And then it was Sylvester Stallone and Billy Dee Williams were the two cops chasing him. But the most famous part of the movie was, similar to the Spider-Man movies, is the climax of the movie takes place on the Roosevelt Island tramway. And it was a great, at that time, it was, you know, before special effects and green screens and all that stuff. It was like one of the first really cool action sequences that takes place in New York City. So that's why it's so memorable. And it was a good cop movie. So Nighthawks, my number 5.
Well, definitely lives up to Under the Radar, because I've not heard of this film. But you know, Sylvester Stallone, great action guy. Yeah, no, I can't say much. I haven't heard of this movie.
I'm trying to pick movies and nobody's seen.
I know. Well, this next one then is the complete opposite, because almost everyone's seen this one. My number 5, Spider-Man. The original, 2002. This one's directed by Sam Raimi and is the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. Also stars James Franco, Willem Dafoe, and Kristen Dunst. I'll say, this is not my favorite Spider-Man film out of the Tobeys, the Andrews, the Toms, but it's the first iteration, live action and high quality, of Spider-Man web-slinging through skyscrapers and, as you said, climax at the tram. Which one? Queensboro?
Was that this one?
Yeah, that was
this
one.
The Roosevelt Island tramway, yeah.
Yeah, it's very pro New York City, because at that scene also, a bunch of New Yorkers get to the bridge and then start throwing trash at Green Goblin, saying, like, you mess with Spider-Man, you mess with New York. Because also, this was in a almost immediately post 9/11 world, and they even had to digitally erase the Twin Towers out of the film, which is very sad. But yes, it's a little cheesy.
Wasn't there a scene, like, they had a cut where he's actually on the Twin Towers? Like...
There was a trailer that was released in the summer of 2001 in which Spider-Man stops a bank robbery and puts the helicopter between the Twin Towers. I see conflicting reports whether it was just filmed for a trailer or if it was actually for the movie and cut, but there is on YouTube a scene where the Twin Towers, there is a helicopter in a web between the Twin Towers. It's pretty cool. But yeah, the visual effects for 2002, 10% of them look a bit cheesy and don't hold up as well. But the film, it's iconic and it's very impactful. And it's probably led to every superhero thing we're seeing. Humongous. $403 million domestically, $822 million worldwide. My number 5, 2002 Spider-Man.
You know, it's really hard. I mean, there have been five Spider-Man movies.
Seven.
No,
wait,
three Tobey Maguire's, two Andrew Garfield's, and two Tom Holland's, but only one took place in New York.
Yeah.
So you have six New York Spider-Man movies to choose from. It's very hard. I mean, because one movie involved had a scene at the Staten Island Ferry. One had a scene at the Brooklyn Bridge, I think. The scene where...
Oh, maybe this was the Brooklyn Bridge.
No, the one where... No, that's where Emma Stone bit it. Didn't she?
No, she bit in like some tower.
Oh.
They had a romantic scene on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Oh, I see.
There are so many bridges in New York. I forgot which one's in the third movie. They're at like a construction site.
Right. And then I know the one with Jamie Foxx. That's also an electrical plant.
That's the electrical plant.
But they'd have a scene in Times Square in that one.
They did have a Times Square scene in The Amazing Spider-Man.
It's hard to choose.
Yeah.
You know? It was
mainly because it was the first and most iconic and pro New York. It felt very pro New York. Like the finale shot is Spider-Man standing next to an American flag. I know it's not New York, but it just feels very patriotic.
All right, we're getting to the big time here. So my number four movie is Ghostbusters, which takes place totally in New York City. It starts, Bill Murray's a professor at Columbia. So that was a scene at Columbia, which it doesn't always get filmed at compared to Harvard and some of the other Ivy League schools. And of course, the climactic scene takes place and the whole thing at Sigourney Weaver's apartment on the Upper West Side, which is if you ever walk in New York City, it's like 63rd or 4th or 5th, I forget. In the 60s, on the West Side is the Ghostbusters building. So, and the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man shows up and he comes from New York and, he comes from Lower Manhattan, walks up. So, it wasn't my favorite Bill Murray movie. It's a little too over the top for me, but it was a summer blockbuster and just a lot of fun. So Ghostbusters, my number four.
Ghostbusters, I've seen the film. I'm aware it's good. I never had the connection to it. I've never been one to, it's on TV, I'll rewatch it right now. When he first said Ghostbusters, I did want to ask the male or the female version, even though I knew you would pick the Bill Murray version. Yeah, I mean, I know it's great.
Their headquarters downtown in the Village.
I did the New York City tour. I went to their fire station. We did the tour that led them to the building, the Ghostbusters building. It is a very iconic New York film. Sadly, just did not make my list. Up for me at number four is, I don't even know if you have this one in your list. It is Escape from New York. I watched it for the first time over the summer. It's a unique idea in which this future of 1997, because this film was made in the 80s, in which the island of Manhattan is now a prison, and the president, he's like flying over in his plane, or his plane crashes and he gets stuck in the island of Manhattan, which is a prison. So they can only send one guy in there to get the job done, to get the president out. Kurt Russell. It stars Kurt Russell in one of his first roles, directed by John Carpenter. And you know, it's a fun short trip through the island of Manhattan. You got people in Grand Central. You have action scenes at the World Trade Center. It's a unique take on the island of Manhattan in a movie, because everything, you know, you have different groups of people, the people that are very violent, like in a prison yard, or people that like hide in the corners to stay safe. I'm going to say it again, it's a very unique idea. They made a sequel, Escape from LA. I did not see that one. This one in the 80s did gross $25.2 million domestically and $25.3 million worldwide. My number four, Escape from New York.
You know, I've never seen it. I never had a desire to see it. I don't know why.
I don't like seeing Manhattan run by criminals.
Picking on Manhattan, you know? I just don't enjoy that. But maybe one day. All right, my number three New York movie is, and I think I might have mentioned this in one of our podcasts, I forget which one, but it's the Die Hard 3, the third Die Hard movie, which basically is filmed in New York, takes place all over New York, a little bit in Westchester, but only a tiny bit. But most of it involves a heist of the Federal Reserve Building in Lower Manhattan. Jeremy Irons sends Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson on a wild goose chase all over New York, whether it's in Harlem or whether it's downtown or whether it's a Yankee Stadium or whether it's in like random parks in the Lower East Side. So New York City is the star of the movie. You know, I mean, obviously it's set in all of New York City and they use New York and all the different parts of it very well. And I love the Die Hard movies. That's my second favorite one. So that is my number three And it's directed by John McTiernan, who did the first one. So, Die Hard 3. Die Hard with a Vengeance, right. That's I call it Die Hard 3.
Die Hard 3. We watched this back in December, my first time. It was right after I watched the first Die Hard. It's an honorable mention. I did actually enjoy this film, and I think it uses New York in a great way. It makes it a treasure hunt, and they have to go through either, you know, the 72nd Street subway stop and use payphones and trash cans and faking a bomb and in a New York crowd or going through parks. As you said, I love that aspect. And you got Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson and Jeremy Irons. Great cast right there. But I knew you'd put it on. So I'm like, you know, diverse the love.
Yeah, I know there's one movie you're going to put it on. So I didn't put it on my list.
Awesome. Up for me at number three. This one, it's a New York film, but it's New York light in which there's a big joke made about in the beginning, and it's set in New York. Let me just get into it. It's They Came Together. This is, if you've known me in the last 5 years, this has grown to be one of my favorite, not just comedies, just one of my favorite films for the actual film itself and just emotional, nostalgic reasons. It is a satire on the New York City rom-com type film in the style of Airplane or Angie Tribeca, where if you said, take your stuff and go, and they give you a suitcase and then your sombrero and then a bunch of cocktails or something like that. It's very funny. It stars Amy Poehler, Paul Rudd, Bill Hader, Kobe Smulders, Jason Mantzoukas, Christopher Maloney, Ed Helms, and so much more. And as I said, it addresses New York City in the first 5 minutes by saying, our love story is, you know, I'm one character, my guy's the second character, and know what the third character is? New York City. And it's played in a very tongue-in-cheeky way. Amy Poehler owns a candy store called Upper Sweet Side. It's a great pun. And they use Brooklyn Promenade in a very funny climax of the film. And in reality, it's all filmed in just a couple blocks in Brooklyn. But hey, that still counts as New York. I absolutely love this film. It is so hard to find on streaming or on TV, because it pops up randomly in places I had to buy the Blu-ray, because I loved it so much. $83,000 worldwide. It was not seen a lot. But yeah, They Came Together. Number three. I love this movie.
I think if they would have come up with a different name for it, like Upper Sweet Side, that would have made it a better, people might have gone to see it. But it was a bad title.
When you say They Came Together, porn's what you think of. Yeah. I'm sorry. They say it though, because they both arrive at the party at the same time. So they say in a name drop, They Came Together. Love it.
Wow. Somebody should be fired. For naming that movie.
It's by the guy who did Wet Hot American Summer, David Wayne.
That's fine, but he just blew the title. All right, my number two, the classic New York love story movie, musical, West Side Story. I know a little bit about it. I mean, besides that, it won so many Oscars. But I believe it was filmed on the West Side of Manhattan, where it takes place, in Hell's Kitchen. It was a very popular Broadway musical. The music is fantastic. Stephen Sondheim wrote the words. Leonard Bernstein wrote the music. And so besides the score being good, it was shot, I mean, you know, a little innovative because it involved racial tensions in the late 50s between the Puerto Ricans and the white kids on Hell's Kitchen. So it was like, you know, and it was like a Romeo and Juliet type of a story. But classic movie, classic scenes. I Like to Be in America, dance on the rooftop of a building. The rumble, When You're a Jet. The opening scene. I would have rather they cut out the somewhere ballet. I'm not a fan of it. It's a waste of time. But that's just my own preference. West Side Story, my number two.
Once again, I've not seen a professional iteration. I saw a bunch of 10-year-olds act this play out. But who knows? I don't know. I think I'd wait until I see the remake and then go to see the original and then go see a Broadway production of it. I think that's the timeline I'll do the West Side Story.
Well, I think once they do this movie, they should stop doing productions of it.
But how am I going to see it now? It's gonna be a bunch of people saying, oh, now I want to see it live again.
Yeah.
It's money. There are a bunch of people behind this. Up for me at number two, this one was a toss-up between number one and two. And then I thought, which one is really more New York? But then which one has a bigger impact on me more? So this is where I ended up. I think this is overall the better film, but it's not my number one, and it's Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. I think this is, it's the dark, depressing side of New York City as it deals with the acting Broadway theater side, and it follows Michael Keaton as a former superhero actor which sounds very familiar to Michael Keaton. And he is now in a Broadway show, and the show's about the fighting for the limelight or the spotlight in the Broadway theater world, and it's just a really well-made movie. It's all deemed to be in one shot, which has been picked up a lot recently since 2014. You got Alejandro Iñárritu directing it, I'm pretty sure he won Best Director for this film, went on to make The Revenant. Also in this movie, you got Emma Stone, Edward Norton, Zach Galifianakis, and Naomi Watts. And also you have the famous running through Times Square in his underwear scene. It's a different side of New York that I feel like a lot of these movies we've mentioned, you don't really get. And also, he ran through Times Square in his underwear. Iconic right there. $42.3 million domestically, $103.2 million worldwide. My number two, Birdman.
Yeah, I forgot all about that movie. though I did see it, and I enjoyed it. I don't think I thought it should win Best Picture, but it did. Yeah, and I still don't get the ending, but whatever.
I don't get it either.
You know, but good choice. Good choice, The Birdman. All right.
Before number one.
Yes.
What were some of the lot of films that just didn't make your list?
Well, Do the Right Thing. I know it's a classic movie. I didn't enjoy it so much, but I know it's a classic Spike Lee movie. The Godfather is a New York movie, but there is a large part of it takes place in Italy. So I nixed that.
Mm.
And I'd probably mentioned before, Brighton Beach Memoirs, the Neil Simon movie with Matthew Broderick that takes place in Brooklyn. The Flamingo Kid, I think I've mentioned it maybe before on a podcast.
I don't think I've heard of that one.
The Flamingo Kid takes place at like one of these like weekend beach cabana clubs in Queens. Maybe it's Long Island, so maybe it doesn't qualify. I won't mention this one because I think it's your number one. Saturday Night Fever. Which is the classic. You know, the end scene of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. But I didn't like Saturday Night Fever, so I didn't include it. Forget it. It's the movies that I enjoy.
That's true.
Then there's Fame.
Yeah.
The movie about the Performing Arts High School in New York City.
Never seen that one.
And that was big with the girls of my senior year in high school. That was a big movie then. Kramer versus Kramer, which is with Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. There's a lot of scenes in Central Park and other places around New York City. Inside Man, I like that Spike Lee movie more than I like than Do the Right Thing. And that takes place at a bank robbery in Lower Manhattan. Wall Street, obviously, with Michael Douglas. And Secret of My Success, it was Michael J. Fox, where he plays like this Wall Street up-and-coming guy in the 80s, and he's like, he works like 26 hours a day or something like that. And the last one is Gangs in New York, even though none of it's filmed in New York. But I just throw it in there because it's Scorsese and said New York in a different time frame.
Yeah. For me, this one also, I just had a bunch of films I was listing off. Muppets Take Manhattan, which I just watched today. I'm like, this is going to be on the list. And it disappointed me. It needed more Manhattan. Other films, Enchanted, love it. It's just on my musical list. Elf, love it. It's on my Christmas list.
I forgot about Elf.
Elf is the iconic Someone is Welcome to New York film. Yeah. Female Ghostbusters, once again got snubbed and is on the honorable mentions. Trainwreck, the Amy Schumer rom-com that takes place in New York. New Year's Eve. I actually like New Year's Eve. I'm not even big on Valentine's Day, but I love New Year's Eve, Gary Marshall, and it's a nice time capsule of 2011. Tower Heist, Eddie Murphy and Ben Stiller. They make a nice use of the Thanksgiving Day parade in that film. Secret Life of Pets, a bunch of pets going throughout New York City. I think it's a very strong New York film. I just not a big fan. Die Hard 3 and Date Night with Steve Carell and Tina Fey, them escaping criminals throughout the city of New York. Very enjoyable.
I also throw in Night at the Museum. I forgot about that one.
True, that one's good.
You know, even though a lot of it was filmed at a museum, it was filmed in Canada, I think, or something. But some of the outdoor shots were filmed on Central Park West outside the museum.
And Anchorman 2, but that was also on my delayed comedy list.
Yeah.
Well, Dad, we are now at the number one film of New York City. I'm kind of intrigued because I'm escaping right now which film can be your number one. So what is your number one?
I'm pretty sure I know your number one movie.
Well, yeah, at this point it might be a given. But what's yours? What's your number one?
My number one is Goodfellas. And,
yeah.
And it's not really like the movie takes place in like New York's Manhattan or anything like that. It's mostly a Queens, Brooklyn movie. And the heist in the movie takes place at JFK Airport, which is Queens. So it still qualifies. But it's one of my... They were just talking about this, that it was in the same years of Dances with Wolves and everybody feels this Scorsese movie should have won Best Picture. So it stars Ray Liotta, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and it's like his best gangster movie. Better than The Departed, better than Casino, better than whatever the movie was, The Irishman.
Irishman.
It is his best, his first one and his best one. And one of the best movies, gangster movies of all time. So Goodfellas is my number one.
Yeah, Goodfellas. I haven't seen Goodfellas. I'm not that big into the whole crime, mafia, mob. They scare me. I am scared of them.
I think this is like, if you're going through my list, I don't know if you've seen like, I don't know, maybe you've maybe seen 2 out of the 10 movies on my list.
This is a weak list on me for you on me.
Yeah.
I've not seen a lot of those films. I know a lot about it. Like, Jeremy needs to force me down. It's like, make me sit down and watch Goodfellas. That's how I'm gonna be able to watch it. There was like maybe a 2 commercial segment period in which you were watching and I'm like, all right, I'm watching Goodfellas. And then we changed the channel. But no, I've not seen Goodfellas. Please don't hurt me, anyone. One day I'll watch Goodfellas. And Dad, you probably guessed it, my number one New York City film, after putting my list together and I thought, well, I like this one, so it keeps on going up, and then just kept on going up and up and up. It is Cloverfield.
Knew it!
I know you don't like disaster films in New York City, leave New York alone, but I like that this one turns it into a unique found footage way. The Clover Monster stomps around New York City, throws the Statue of Liberty head at a bunch of people. I think they destroy the Brooklyn Bridge in this one. You got an intense scene where they're walking through the subway and have to fight off a bunch of critters. The Coney Island backstory, per se. You got the climax in Central Park. I love them running around New York City, even though, I'm sorry, Dad, it wasn't mostly filmed in New York City. I'm sorry. But you got Matt Reeves as the director, J.J. Abrams as the producer. You got Lizzie Kaplan. And I also have T.J. Miller. But besides that, I love that you don't get almost any answers in this film. But that's why I still love it. Because in a way, it is found footage. Like, whatever you get is found in these 80 minutes. Also, it's 80 minutes. Very quick, in and out. It builds up a lot of mystery. The online campaign, which I was not around of at the time, but reading about it now, unbelievable. $80 million domestically, $171 million worldwide. My number one New York City film, Cloverfield.
You know, I was surprised they released that. I remember, like, I think it was at the Super Bowl, maybe it was the Golden Globes that year, because they released it in January, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was
and
a January
I was like,
film.
Why release this? This was like a really good, like, it would have been a great summer movie, could have been a great Halloween movie. I think they look, I don't know why they released it in January.
The issue was, it had a big opening. The issue is, it made 50% of its opening week, of its total in its opening weekend. The legs, it did not last long, because I think a bunch of people got pissed off that, in a way, it didn't have a lot of rewatchability at first. But I didn't like it that much at first. But over the course of time, and thinking like this small piece of, in a way, 80 minutes of a monster disaster, it's like such a unique thing that found footage kind of got drilled into a hole, but
I think
it's
another
so
movie like that where you don't see the killer, all right? Maybe like the Blair Witch Project, maybe. But
yeah, I'd say Blair Witch. Like, you get like maybe 40 seconds total of the monster, but most times it's hidden in shadows or like off camera, and it's cool. Builds up mystery. I love Cloverfield. Beware if you get motion sickness, because they run around with the camera a lot in that. But yeah, we did it. We went through New York City.
And I think we hit almost, well, we didn't really hit Staten Island, so I thought you were going to pick King of Staten Island.
Yeah, but I don't even think of it that much as a New York film.
But I definitely think we hit 4 out of the 5 boroughs.
Yeah, we did good.
Yeah, we didn't even do a Bronx Tale.
This is a Bronx Tale. But yeah, I loved making this list. I think that, once again, we have brought a bunch of unique films that we haven't talked about before. So hopefully, viewers, you get some inspiration to watch one of these films. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me on this list today. And audiences, if you don't know, you can actually support the show, Mr. Movie, by going to anchor.fm/Joshua-Bergman/support. You can donate $10, $5, or just $1 a month. Once again, that is anchor.fm/Joshua-Bergman/support. Jeff, thank you once again for joining me. Do you have any last words?
Enjoy your vacation, Mr. Movie.
Thank you. I, audience, am going to be taking a brief vacation, at least for a week. And then after that, I will say, I'm going to be taking a bit more time on some episodes, given just, you know, the effort, since I do produce, record, and edit all these episodes. It takes a lot out of me. You never know, some work stuff might be coming out. So don't be afraid or don't be scared if I release less episodes in the upcoming weeks. But just remember, watch movies, love movies, and go see them in the theaters. They need you this summer. Once again, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me. And audiences, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you tune in next time.